Hey, folks, and welcome to the podcast. First order of business to wish you a good new year coming up. Hope your holidays went well. Mine went well. Thanks for asking. Today's guest is Chris Stamey. I cannot overstate how important those first two DB's albums were to me. They just changed the way I thought about songwriting and performing and record making. And they still do to this day. Just, they're fantastic albums. If you're not into those, get into them pronto. Chris Stamey was kind enough to limit our conversation to that early time, a time which he talks about quite a bit in his book, which I recommend. And he's got some stuff you can check out. ChrisStamey.com is the place for information. The original idea was for him to come and sing some songs. We'd play some records and talk. He had a sore throat. He still sang a little bit and illustrated some stuff with the guitar, but there were no performances of songs, which is... So if you were expecting that, that's what was advertised. I'm sorry, he just wasn't feeling well. But we ended up just really chatting for most of the hour, and I think it's kind of fascinating. It's definitely not for everybody. Not everything's not for everybody. That's one of my slogans. Anyway, another fantastic year, or interesting year, busy year, and I just want to tell you I appreciate you supporting the show, the podcast, etc. Hopefully the next year I'll figure something to make the show better, new, etc. Anyway, here it is, my chat with Chris Stamey of the DBs. Chris Stamey, welcome to WFMU. Welcome back to WFMU. How are you?
Always great to be here.
I don't know if you heard that Frank O'Toole passed away this year.
I didn't know that.
He did, I think perhaps Frank was the first host to have you here.
Yeah. Yeah. And a regular at Maxwell's, as I recall.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. I don't think, yeah.
That's sad.
Yeah, it is sad, but another link in the chain, a long link in the chain. What year would you have first come down to WFMU, the old WFMU in the house?
Could it have been maybe not till 81?
That sounds probably
that whole
right
period, there. All those years from when I first moved to New York in 77 and up through like 84, each year contained about a decade for me, so it's hard to pin it down.
Because life was moving so fast, because so much was happening?
I think so, yeah.
I asked you if you could come here today, and we could talk mostly about the events leading up to and the creation of the first two DB's albums. And I think it's important to explain why, because two reasons. One, personally, those records changed my life in a way. And as I was thinking about it, it's because they were such a surprise to me. And I liked FM album rock mostly, a little pompous. I loved AM top 40 rock. And then when sort of newer music came in high school, I completely gravitated to the Niccolo, Elvis Costello, Cars, Cheap Trick side of the world. So as I was writing a post about this show on Facebook, I sort of had to put it into words. And it was, you know, those first two DB albums were made up of rock and roll vocabulary that I understood, yet it was a lot of surprises, sonically and lyrically, subject matter, vocal performances, complete, you know, much more open and sort of honest sounding to me, really connected with, you know, and a little bit of dissonance also, I think, is a key part of what makes those two records what they are and different. So a pleasant surprise. I mean, anybody can make a record that sounds different, but to make one that sounds different and still connects to people, super important. And then as I come to WFMU, every time I play one of those tracks off of those first two records, I always find that there's lots and lots of people who had the same experience, who those records really opened their eyes or changed their world, or they saw the band live, or there's some connection. And it really is just about that music connecting with people. Do you feel that? Are you aware of that? Or do you only just listen to, you know, oh, that's my bass playing is bad on that song? Or, you know, is it that kind of a thing? I wish I could remix that one more time. Do you hear the emotional?
Well, I do have a hard time with the records. I do hear a lot of mistakes. And I think anyone would tell you that that's the case. But I find a lot of joy and exuberance in those records, too. I was much more hands-on on the first one. For the second one, we had Scott Litt in there. And he was a kid like us, but he was the diplomat. And so there were fewer layers on that second repercussion record. And it fit those songs really well. But on Stands for Decibels, it was an explosion for us. I remembered somebody asking Alex Chilton if why were you compressing everything so much in those days? And he said, well, it was like a kid in a candy store. And I think we had the keys to the candy store, and there was nobody stopping us. I mean, Alan Bettrock was a great guy, putting out New York Rocker magazine, and very wise in his own way, and lived upstairs and helped us produce those records. But really, it was more the band. And for better or worse, at that time, it was probably I had a large part of that. And
right, but a lot of people, when given the keys to the candy store, listen to what's on the radio and say, let's use these tools to make our song sound like exactly like whatever, Tom Petty or whatever, the best of what is on the radio. And you guys didn't do that.
Well, I don't want to be completely honest, it was a little later when the idea of making truckloads of money making rock music came in. A few people were successful, but these U2 amounts of money, or whoever you want to pick, had withered away in our scene. And we didn't really have filthy lucre dangling in front of us. And we also really wanted to flex our muscles and see what we could do. I mean, it was a passion project with no real record label. The record label came later. A lot of the people you're talking about probably are already hooked up with someone making T-shirts for them and a tour booked, and the economy is more of it. But we were not thinking.
But still, you know, I mean, even when I was in high school, there were bands I knew who were going to make a demo so because they wanted to, quote, try to get signed, whatever that meant. And, you know, and it was a means to an end, and the road was, you know, straight down the middle. You guys didn't do that at all. You know?
So I think you're asking about a musical vocabulary on those records that seems different from other folks, and why we might have, for example, recorded parts backward, or we, you know, on cycles per second. We recorded a lot of stuff at different speeds on different tracks without listening to what was going on, and then in the mix we would push those layers up at random, so every mix was quite different. And we didn't know about, is it Strawberry? No, Tomorrow Never Knows as that technique, or in any case, we weren't thinking about that. I'd been at the University of Music School, so I'd been at a lot of like seminars with Robert Crumb, having a soprano sing into a piano to vibrate the notes, prepared piano. So there were definitely some what was called new music, mid-century new music techniques that I kind of filtered in to the mix. But everybody in the band was wide open to ideas. I mean, and a lot of theirs maybe were more solid than mine. I mean, I remember when Peter said, well, okay, we're recording a song called The Fight. Let's go get as many light bulbs as we can afford and put them in a bag and smash them. And it was a great sound.
Right.
But I think one more thing about that.
Sure.
And I was trying to... oftentimes, when I do these rare interviews these days, it makes me think about life in general and what the hell I'm doing. Can you say that? I guess you can say that on
sure.
You can say anything on WFMU, right? And I think really it comes down to curiosity, in the same way that a kid might be at the beach and look at a shell, another shell, and just say, how do these fit together? I think that everybody, all my peer group from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, was very curious. And so you that's a kind of right brain thinking where you just, what will happen here? Let's try this. And I'm not sure that that's really an evolutionary Darwinian asset. I mean, I understand procreation. There seems to be some value in that, fight or flee. But
interesting.
I don't know why. It seems like curiosity would have killed off as much of the species as it wouldn't. Nevertheless, I think that might be partially what you're looking for there. We were really curious making those records and trying to make each song different.
Also, you have four guys in their 20s with this curiosity, and like you said, with sort of the keys to the candy store. It's just a chemistry that, you know, can't be repeated. Do you ever try to invoke that when you're working now, like when you're producing an artist or you're in your studio and you try to get somebody to be creative? You know, how do you motivate? Can you motivate that into somebody, or do you just have to have that kismet?
Well, you want to get out of the way. And generally, artists are curious. I think that is still a mode of thinking of that, gee, what happens? And that's how songs are written.
Some
generally
are, but some, I think.
I haven't worked with those guys.
Yes, right. I think maybe I'm a little cynical, but yes, I think a lot of artists think, how can I sound like other artists who's already famous and rich? But yes, that's a different world, perhaps.
I mean, generally, I don't know about that. I mean, as a record producer, I found a lot of inspiration, and the same kind of curiosity is brought to the table. I remember I worked with this band called La Tigra that Kathleen Hanna and her compatriots, and it was a wonderfully creative time, and I learned so much from them, and everything was questioned musically. Ryan Adams, starting out, we're recording with Ryan Adams, and every time he walked into the studio, it's like, where can we go? This is amazing. Let's do something great. And, I think these traits are valuable, and I guess you're right. All four people in the DBs shared them, and at that time, there was some combustion.
Yeah, it's lucky. And perhaps a little traumatic on everyone involved. I don't know, from reading your accounts, you know, in the book.
Was my book that revealing of that? My book is book really about specific songs and what was associated with them.
But about the time, I mean, I find that time in New York extremely curious because, you know, you talk about the Wrecking Crew or the Tin Pan Alley or the Brill Building, and those are scenes that have been movies and plays and memoirs to death. But that New York City time of transition, such an interesting time to me. And
it was tiny. I mean, there were, I would guess, 200 people in that little scene at CBGB.
They all got signed to record deals, though. You know?
Yeah, or we're all doing other kind of creative things. And because nobody had a car, you'd see them on the streets all the time. And it was just a ride around the Village or Tribeca. And art, you know, art openings, and I mean, were a big part of it, as well as the nighttime clubbing. And everybody was kind of saying, like, where can we go? What's new? I mean, the things like Charles Ball was doing with DNA later on, or the what was called the No Wave, what Lydia was doing. There were some very creative things there as well.
And clearly that's, I mean, I've always guessed that you brought that element into the DBs, that sort of dissonant factor, but it was so
nobody
controlled.
In the band was a slouch in the way, and I think some of what you're talking about, we did have a predilection for major second. We really like two whole notes. What is it? Dynamite is that? I mean, what is Dynamite? You know, there's a lot of that. That particular clash was very attractive. Yeah.
Yeah. And it keeps the listener on its toes, and it's exciting to listen to. But it can be, you know, murder if overused or used wrong. And for me, that is the key to the DBs, is that sort of moderation. You know, it's just touching the boundaries of all these different feelings and bringing them all in to amplify the song, you know. So you moved to New York City in 1977.
I'd been coming up for a while.
You've been coming up for a while. Obviously not culture shock for you, right? These were your people here? Is that how you felt?
I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, I don't know. I love New York. I'd come up from when I was a little kid, and my dad was a doctor, and he would stay in Midtown, and I didn't really know what downtown was all about, but... Huh. I mean, I'd heard the Tony Hatch, Petula Clark song, but that was actually written about Times Square, so it didn't tell you a whole lot. Coming over, I stayed in with friends in Brooklyn and rode the train in to be here today, and it was the same. I just think Manhattan is about as good as it gets. I don't know. I love how filthy and chaotic it is. I wonder... I think you either have to be pretty smart or pretty rich to live here. And those may overlap. I just don't know the pretty rich
side. Or really young, too.
And yeah, that might help, too.
If you don't mind eating rice and beans and sleeping on the floor or whatever, you know. Yeah, but when you get a little older, yeah, it's tough, and it's getting tougher. I just anecdotally, how cheap was New York when you got here?
Well, I rented a room up right above Carnegie Hall in Alwyn Courts, which is kind of like the Dakota when I first got here. And I think it was $150 a month from my friends. And then when I moved downtown, my Bleecker Street apartment was about $425 a month.
Oh, wow. Which,
you know, was a hefty sum.
But
at the time.
As I remember reading in the book, you did work as a busboy and other sort of jobs?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You mean to eat?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, so did like Tina and Chris from Talking Heads. And I mean, yeah.
Where were you busing there?
Spring Street Bar. I was waiting there after a while with a lot of cool folks I still communicate with. And, you know, it was cool. I mean, John Chamberlain would come in and pay the bar bill with paintings or sculptures, I guess, or car parts or
whatever.
It was a cool scene down there. I mean, I think I've had a lot. I was worked for ambulance chaser lawyers on Wall Street at one point. Let's see, other menial jobs. I've done a lot of copy editing in my life. I hate to call being a record producer a menial job, but there's a certain digging ditches element to that.
As a record producer, you'll work with whoever calls you on the phone?
No, only if I can feel that at times this is the greatest thing ever.
Okay.
I will mix for anybody. I'm happy to mix records.
And your website has a long how to get your mix ready for me.
Oh, does it? I've got to look at that sometime. It's been a while.
I think, I don't know if it's out of frustration on your part or just trying to help the world prepare their mixes so that efficient mixing can happen.
I was
a
columnist for Tape Op magazine for a while, so I think some of that was ported over, but
that's interesting.
Yeah, I should probably update that.
Yeah,
or
you
at least
should
look at it.
Let's play a track. I want to talk a little bit about the band Television because I know they kind of blew your mind permanently at a certain point. Is there a song that directly in your head wouldn't exist? A song of yours that if it wasn't for them?
Oh, that's a good question. You mean if I name it, you could play it?
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that directly, actually. Happenstance, maybe, although I don't know if other people will see that.
Huh. What's the play that first chord. What is that first chord in that song, Happenstance?
Oh, well, it's got stuff in it. It's like, I mean, it's basically just an E9. But they're little, you know, things going on. I mean, it's essentially the minor five of the key. It's, you know, it's going to go dot. It's pretty much folk chords after that.
How interesting.
But that was supposed to, that was actually rendered with mallets on guitars.
Of course.
It was kind of a thing in New York to have these mallet guitar concerts and so we took that, and then I think we used noise gates, so the mallet guitar, they opened up louder when the toms were played.
Oh, wow.
And the other thing, another good musicology thing about that is we mixed it at George Martin's studio, and we needed crickets, or we put crickets on the middle section, and it probably had like Television-like noises before that, but we replaced it with crickets. And then when I had to play a concert of Abbey Road, I realized they were the same crickets as on Abbey Road. It was just like they pull them out of the EMI library.
The stock crickets. Wow.
Yeah.
That's funny. We're going to hear, Chris Damey's our guest, we're going to hear the DBs' Happenstance. Just briefly, how the DBs worked, you would write a song on acoustic guitar in your kitchen and bring it in, or you would jam it up, or how would it be presented to the band?
I think both Peter and I wrote words and music together and we present it to the band, but this was not necessarily on paper. It was sometimes just walking around in our heads.
And then what percent better does the song get, like Happenstance, when the other three guys throw their ideas on it?
And Scott Litt,
who was
involved in it, the producer. World's better. I mean, I can't give you a number.
I need an exact
number.
All right.
I know. Great. I mean, everybody. I mean, in terms of actual notes and rhythms and arrangement, everybody would contribute. But this was not a band of jamming. It was we were bringing in pretty finished songs, and then if they didn't click, they were thrown away.
Huh. Okay. For your solo album later, or
no, probably just
thrown away. Wow. Yeah. Oh, sad. Here's the DB's Happenstance more with Chris Stamey, just in a minute.
Run back to your mother, tell her all the cruel things that I did. Comes as no surprise to her, I was never smooth enough for her kid. A mother knows what's best, she said. A mother knows what's good. So run back to your mother, she always said you would. Happenstance we fell into, off the cuff, the trolley remark. All I ever wanted was to make you so damn happy. But the mother knows what's best, she said. A mother knows what's right. So run back to your mother, out of mind, out of sight. Think for yourself. Think of me, think of what I'm saying. Think for yourself. Think for yourself. Think for yourself. Come back to me. When it happened, as it happened, it was the worst thing I've ever felt. Someday in your cul-de-sac you'll realize what it meant. A mother knows what's best, she said. Your ballerina curls. So run back to your mother like a good little girl. Think for yourself. Think it through. Don't let her. Think of me, think of what I'm saying. Think for yourself. Think for yourself now. Think for yourself. You come back. She walks into the room so late at night. Shuts the window, Luna bright. She brushes you off and tucks you in and plants a kiss. Your mother knows what's best, she said. A mother knows what's good. So run back to your mother, she always said you would. She always said you would. Think for yourself, think it through. Don't let her live for you. Think for yourself.
There's Happenstance from the DBs. We didn't pay strict attention, but it's, to me, like, those kind of records just blow me away totally.
Yeah, to me, I'm singing it like a kid, and I can tell I'd seen a lot of shows by television at that point. It's a little bit over-dramatic, I guess.
Huh. In the book, I mean, I read the book a long time ago, but I think that was one of the things that drew you to television was the dramatic singing. You know?
Well, no, you know, I think I was hearing ideas that were similar to some of the academic modern music I was interested in.
Hmm.
you know, Crumbs of Black Angels or, you know, some of the approach to the guitar. I think Verlaine had played saxophone before and was like an Albert Ayler fan. And, you know, originally the band, I've read that the band wanted Rudy Van Gelder to produce that record, and the label wouldn't go for that.
Would have been interesting.
Certainly. Yeah, weird probably, but you know, it would have been good.
Clean sounding, it would have been.
But I liked a lot of the instrumental things, but I liked the passion, and I liked the. I mean, I saw them live in I think maybe 75, and I went back to North Carolina and just was raving about them, and people thought I was a nut. And, I mean, what you know? What nobody's ever heard of this band. Lisa Robinson had a few pictures in Rock Scene, but and they looked like they were poor. And, you know, we didn't know. But when I saw him, I thought, you know, really what I always thought an electric band could do. It was like a dream come true.
Huh.
So, and then Little Johnny Jewel convinced everybody in North Carolina. I think that's still a great record. I've arranged it for a small string trio, and I've been playing it recently in the last couple of years. And, I mean, there are a lot of, just from a musicology point of view, there are a lot of cool phrases in that record.
I remember, I think it was one of those things they used to have at the nightclub, the defunct nightclub, The Bottom Line, where four or five songwriters would sit around and Vince Gels or somebody would interview them.
I did
them.
One of those, yeah.
Right. And I think it was there for you. And they would ask you about your songs, and then everyone would be asked to play one cover. And I believe you played Venus by Television.
Quite possibly. Yeah. I do it often.
And you said you used to listen to it every day, you know, for years.
That's probably hyperbole. But I like that record.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic record. Let's talk about Alex Chilton for a minute. I believe the story goes Terry Ork of Ork Records was going to put out an Alex Chilton record or something like that and said, Chris, you find a band to back this
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, I met Terry on a couple of trips up, and he, you know, basically, if you shake his hand, he says, "Okay, you're on the label." Terry had me playing with a band called the Erasers, and then he said, "Well, this Alex Chilton guy's coming up," and I already was totally involved in those Big Star records. I had a cassette of the third record, which I liked a lot, and they were a hit band in our town, nowhere else maybe, but they were top 10 on the radio with a couple of singles on that first record. And I'd called up Ardent and talked to them about how the records were made and all.
When you're a teenager, or
in college, yeah.
There's some pictures in the book of you lugging around this pretty gigantic, bigger than a toaster oven, reel-to-reel tape recorder, and looked like a young boy.
Mitch Easter and I were big fans of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and there was no way affordable way to record the video, but we got a tape recorder so we could record The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And then they invented the cassette, which of course was a step up. And we got a Wallensack cassette player. I think we each got one for Christmas and had a radio station. So we were kind of techie in that way. Before playing music, it was tape recorders. And we would record things backward, and we would do little tricks with the, you know, we'd edit a monkey's record, things like that.
That's perfect. It's important, I think, to point out that the three guys who ended up being in the DBs with you were all guys that you'd known for
far too long.
Since you were little boys, just a grade below you,
I met Mitch, I think, in summer of first grade. The others years later, like fifth grade,
old yeah. man of fifth grade. That's a long time to know people. Yeah,
and I mean, we were thinking about playing next week in Chapel Hill at the Cat's Cradle Festival they're doing, and we were back at it. I think we're actually not going to play in the end because Gene Holder can't make it, and we have a local stand-in guy on bass, Mitch Easter, who also can't make it. So I guess we're actually not going to play.
But okay.
Yeah, I see them all the time.
That's too bad. One of the interesting things to me about DBs that makes them unusual, and I was thinking about it, and it doesn't seem that unusual, but then when you look at the landscape of bands, it's very unusual to have a band with two frontmen, two songwriters, two strong visions. It's very, very unusual to have a band that does that.
That's what Alan Betrock said when we started the band. Yeah, he pointed that out. I mean...
The Beatles,
Mitch, Peter, and I had I keep talking about this guy, Mitch Easter. He had a band called Let's Active, and he's a producer in North Carolina, and part of our...
And it was with bands with you for
right.
years.
Right, so me and Peter and Mitch had already had a band, and we were all writing for it, so it seemed easier to only have two writers. Huh. Although, I guess in that band, Peter and Mitch wrote much more than I did.
Huh. So one less writer, was that the
one
you were
looking at? Yeah, it was a
breeze. I see. In some ways, half the pressure off you, right? You don't have to sing as much, you don't have to write as much, but in the other hand, half the spotlight off you also. Is that a tough balance?
I was always, he can have all the spotlight. I was interested in having the songs recorded, and it did get to be a problem. We had what seemed at the time flawed technology, meaning vinyl, which I know we have changed our opinions about.
Right, 44 but, minutes or whatever. Yeah.
We were just hitting a point by that second record where there were a lot of songs that seemed good that we could not record and put on the record. I had a song I really liked called Depth of Field. I was very proud of it. And Peter had an incredible song called Nothing Is Wrong. And in the end, it seemed like the better move to record Nothing Is Wrong. And that seemed like it was only going to get worse at that point to me. And that, I guess, is what I remember as being the reason I asked for a volunteer, somebody to leave the band, and everybody else stepped back. Not really. I said, guys, you go on, and because we can't, there are too many songs. This is not working.
Huh. That's a little heartbreaking, but that's what, and you felt fine with that. I'm just going to start making solo records and. You look back, you're happy with that decision at that time?
I don't really second guess like that, but. Yeah, I mean, it was a gift, I guess, in the end. I think I stumbled a few times. It was definitely harder. I had been in a lot of vans and a lot of classrooms with those guys, and it meant for a situation where everybody was very honest. So it changed to a situation where a session guy would come in and play, and they're going to kind of say, oh, yeah, that's a great part, even if it isn't.
That's a totally new thing to learn. That's really interesting. Yeah, because when you, yeah.
Not. But, I mean, I was still working with friends after that, and I did some stuff with Marshall Crenshaw, who was great, and more with Scott Litt. And, I can't say that any, I mean, I've just been really, really lucky in my life, if you look at it against the perimeter of being allowed to make music.
Sure, yeah. Lots of guys have a guitar and write songs, yeah. And, yeah, anyone who gets to reach people is lucky. But you've also crossed paths with so many cool people, and you've organically grown this thing, and somehow you have the ability not to look back and kick yourself, which is rare, I think. A lot of musicians spend a lot of time doing that, yeah.
Well, I don't actually listen to the old stuff, so I don't kick myself too much. I've been way on this creative binge right now. I got a piano back, and all of a sudden, all 10 fingers can hit different notes. So I'm writing these new songs with a little bit of a different harmonic vocabulary, or I'm trying to learn more about how Thelonious Monk and Cole Porter and Jerome Kern and that crowd were moving around. You look at all the things you are, and it modulates through, like, every key. And this is the latest version of me being on the beach looking at these colored pebbles and trying to assort them. I'm really into the vocabulary of what's called the Great American Songbook.
Yeah, there is a sort of seamlessness to that to the older idea of pop music writing that is less contemporary pop is more, all those little things are in your face, all those key changes, and there's like a seamlessness in those. You've got your newest record is called New Songs for the 20th Century, and there's information I want to mention on chrisstamey.com about that record, and you're playing a gig City Vineyard tonight at 7:30, which is an awesome venue. I love that.
Great.
It's a lovely, intimate venue and very civilized and just in a beautiful spot. But the record is very much sort of new standards feeling to it, I think, your newest record.
Right. Well, this is a record that is available on CD and you download it and in the normal way. But to me, the record lives on paper. I wrote these songs. I wrote the melodies and the chord changes and some of the rhythms on a piece of paper and then put it on the desk and it was done.
Huh.
And these are realizations of the songs, but I'm really into this totally silent artifact.
It exists
on the paper. Yeah. And I guess I've got I'm trying to write two more. I just finished a new record of the, in the same way, of just music on paper in the jazz format, which is usually 32 bar. It's very restricted in some ways. And
that is a language that not a lot of people speak anymore, you know.
Well, they're called jazz musicians. They do. but, you know, it's a fascinating language, and it also opens up lyrically. There a lot of pop music walks on the, you know, one syllable, two syllable tight path, and all of a sudden being able to be a little polysyllabic, which is that an onomatopoeia? That's not onomatopoeia. Polysyllabic defines itself, kind of. it, you know, it's just a lot of fun. I don't know. I'm fascinated by it at the moment. I'm still write other kinds of music, but also when it's on a piece of paper, the vocal ranges don't have to match me. It doesn't have to be a confessional. It doesn't have to be in my own voice. And this is fascinating, too. I mean, tonight, Ariel Pocock is going to sing about half the set, and she's just got a great voice, and she's a highly skilled jazz pianist. So I'm very excited about that aspect. I love to hear her sing the songs. The thing that's strange about being here with you, that I mean, by coincidence, it's not maybe of interest to your audience, I don't know, but when we talk about the CBGB scene, where a lot of it was Terry Ork of Ork Records and his partner Charles Ball, who his business partner, and Charles Ball was a very interesting guy who recorded a lot of the No Wave scene and managed Alex Chilton, and he was also Ariel Pocock's dad's roommate at college.
Wow.
That seems strange that you're
it's
on
a small
stage
world,
with
yeah.
Prodigy. Yeah.
Let's talk about, because you mentioned those guys, the other three guys in the DBs. Just briefly, Peter brought these great songs, this great voice, originally just the organ player, and then a real great match for you as a two-guitar band, not, you know, just both doing the same thing ever, basically. Gene and Will, can you explain and unpack a little bit about what made those guys such a compelling rhythm section?
I played with Peter in a blues band when blues was king, to quote Marshall Crenshaw, and in eighth grade. And then he started a band at a certain point called Little Diesel and the Weasels, and I went to see him, and there was this explosion on drums. I mean, what Keith Moon could only dream of being. Well, that, maybe that's hyperbole, but... And it was Will Rigby. I mean, you could...
Don't ever apologize for hyperbole. Just take the joke.
I hate hyperbole. I want to kill hyperbole.
There you go.
It should die. you know, Will was a phenomena, a teenage phenomena there. And we just kept playing off and on in different things. But he and Peter were a unit to begin with. So, in a way, Peter brought him to the table. And, you know, when I hear somebody good, and my ears perk up, and I don't forget it. I have a, I probably should have been an A&R guy rather than this useless music stuff. and definitely my ears perked up at Will. And Gene Holder was just the best bassist in town, and the best guitarist in the DB, certainly. He's really a good player, and he was my dear friend. I mean... it was just one of these DBs were just one of these combinations. We had so many bands with the, you know, 8 or 10 players, musical chairs, and it was just one that fell into the hothouse of Manhattan at the end of the 70s. And
you need the guys, and you said, why not call the two best guys? And they came, and lucky for you, they came up here. Yeah, and then Peter soon after. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I invited him up because Ork was putting out a single. Oh, I'd done a record with Richard Lloyd, and all of a sudden it couldn't be a Richard Lloyd record.
I thought you wanted to know, Richard wrote it and he sort of conned you into singing it, maybe?
No. Elektra called up and said, oh, Richard, we actually have you signed as an artist, so you can't go put out a single on Chris's label. And I'd invested like all my money. I mean, it was like $200.
Gee, like your waiter money? Is this how you had a small label car?
Yeah, I couldn't throw that kind of lucre away.
And no.
So he suggested I sing it, and I mixed it as a record of mine.
Yeah.
And then I asked Gene Holder and Will Rigby to, would they come up and play a couple of shows with me?
And years later, they were still here.
Gene's still here, as a matter of fact.
So the first record stands for Decibels in your book, and we've sort of touched on this, but I wrote down your quote, "It has not worn well for me." But just to reemphasize, you do understand it means a lot to a lot of people.
Well, you know, I tried to dial the snark out of my book, but that was honest. And then actually we got together and played some of those songs, and I would retract that now. I do enjoy it pretty much, and I get it more.
Okay.
I just, you know, Peter's a better singer than I am and was, particularly at that time. And, you know, it's a little hard for me to hear that.
That's interesting. So I don't, no one hears that but you, just FYI. So let's talk about the songwriting again. The songs on these records were things that you labored over for weeks, months, or they just popped out in actual time? Or what's your process like? Are you a guy with napkins in your pocket with scribbles, or how does it work?
I've thought a lot about this, and I've actually been lecturing at universities about it, if you can, including recently at Yale for their neuroscientist, their psychiatric department. And I do think a lot about creativity. I've tried to look at it, but basically I feel like what I tell songwriters is you have to do the craft ahead of time, because that moment when all of a sudden you're seeing in your peripheral vision and you feel like this, you know, the cliche is about, oh, a song is coming out. It is actually the way it works. And generally, it seems like it takes 15 minutes to write a song. It's probably, you've lost track of time and it's actually an hour. But that's the time. That's not the time to go on the internet and try to figure out how a G7 chord works. You need to know that ahead of time so that you're ready to be swept away in those right brain moments of creativity. And another thing that's really important is give yourself a break and don't do the laundry or miss the dentist appointment. Because if you don't stick with it in that frame of mind when it's easy, you're not going to get back there. You're never going to write that second verse, even though it seems at the time it's easy to do that. Songwriting is a very precious form, because it's a miniature form. You know, if you write a piece for an orchestra, it's like doing architecture, and it's many months of work. But a song can sweep you away and be there before you in very little time. And it sneaks up on you. But, I mean, there are ways to help this. And the same thing's about, people talk about writer's block. I mean, think about starting early in the morning, maybe some coffee, getting the light just right. These are important. But for the songs on the DB's record, we already knew that if you go to a half diminished chord here, it's going to do this certain thing. If you put in a 3/4 bar, it'll have this kind of effect. We'd already been through the mill, you know, laboring over our Genesis records or whatever I shouldn't mention here. And, you know, like, what is it? Careless at the start, cautious at the end. So that's a, you know, it's a flat 9 interval over a B chord, and then it goes to a 13th over the next chord. And this is stuff that made sense to us, but we did our homework.
But so yes, you've got to have your tools ready, because you don't want to go looking for them when inspiration strikes. But I was thinking about inspiration, and it's such an interesting thing. What can inspire people? You can have a new baby, and that will inspire you to have feelings you did not feel, or you can hear a Nick Lowe song on the radio, and that may make you go, oh, that's a thing, a groove I'm really interested in exploring. Or you can be jealous of someone and that can inspire, you know, there's so many different things that literally will inspire you, you know, or love, certainly, you know, I want to express this thing.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm also big on the whole Muse theory. I'd read the books by Picasso's mistresses and, you know, that, and found some resonance there, frankly. A problem for me was when, well, when I met my wife, all of a sudden I was writing all these happy songs, and it's I was proud of them and still am, but they had less resonance than some of the Torch songs and some of the things from when I was much less consistently
That's
happy.
That's very interesting. Yes, your signature was not happiness, especially on those. You know, you brought your guitar, and I know you're not feeling well, and you've been kind enough to kind of give us a musical illustration so far, but do you want to sing part of a song or a song?
I'm walking that tight line between, from Tom Waits to Johnny Mathis, and I think I need to keep my feet on the ground until I get
that's
to Johnny.
Fine.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. I just wanted to check in.
I think I picked up a little something on the plane.
Tonight at City Vineyard, 7:30 tonight. Like I said before, it's a great venue. It's just small and intimate, and every table can hear and see well. So great. That's what you want.
And they're going to be hearing me and Ariel. But I should say that Tony Shear is a big part of this gig, too, and it's great to be playing with him. You probably know him from shows with Bill Frisell or from or with Nora Jones. I mean, he's like the creme de la creme of New York bassist in my world right now. And So we've not cut out the middleman. We're not using a drummer, so you can really hear what the bass does, and he's fantastic.
Oh, great! Have you got a song? Let's play. I want to play. Our whole plan went into the drain, but I think our new plan has been even better. But let's play. I want to play one more song off these records for these people. Just to illustrate what we're talking about for those who need to discover these records. Have you got a choice?
Well, I mean, Peter brought a song in called Big Brown Eyes one day. Is that not one we have?
No, we have them. I just had only sort of...
You should
put yours on the
computer. Where are the cue cards?
But I can... But I can get Big Brown Eyes off this if you like.
Sure, that'd be great. I was going to say just because I've been playing and singing it recently myself.
And did this song blow your mind when you first got it?
Well, it was very short. It was a minute 10, and... I think this was part of my creative thing. Peter, you got to put in a guitar solo in one more verse, and we bumped it up to, like, is it 2:05 now?
2:01.
Yeah, just to get it over that 2-minute mark.
But
it's such a beautiful little miniature.
You just said add another verse and a guitar solo. You made him do that.
I had him put in more time. I think that is probably what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, it's clever. Minor 4, we had the little intro. I mean, the bridge, you know. You give me something to think about, I'll give you something to live without. And then. Suspending that note over that's really cool.
And all of that was
flat 3.
He brought.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Peter's like the king of rhythm guitar parts that actually work. I'm the king of, like, making noise.
It packs a tremendous amount into 2 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. All right. Let's hear this one. Back with more Chris Damey right after Big Brown Eyes. Just, yeah, love the song.
Sorry, bud.
Every time I look into your big brown eyes, I get paralyzed, paralyzed. Take a step down. Every time I think about the thousand guys who want you, I realize. Every time you take a step down, you give me something to think about, I'll give you something to live without. And you give me something to take the day away. Something to think.
something to think about. I'll give you something to live without. You give me something to take the day away.
You know, talked about sort of writing symphonies, but that song is kind of a minor symphony there. It is just, it's, you know, perfect, yeah. Well, I don't know. There's so much to talk about in so little time. You're making Repercussions. Scott Litt was the producer, and you ran, and Paul McCartney was working down the hall. Is that right?
He and George Martin were making Ebony and Ivory at that time.
And did he invite you around, or did he, what was the interaction?
Well, you know, every morning they would come, he and Linda and sometimes Lulu would come in and for their session, and it always popped their heads in and, you know, in our room, and we were grumpy, and after like the third day we're saying, can we keep that guy out of here? You know, kind of sarcastically, of course, in awe. But...
that's great.
Yeah, I think I was enjoying a little bit of Anglophobia at that point. I do remember one night, late at night by the Coke machine, McCartney and I were just standing there alone, and he was just being really friendly and wanting to talk. You know, he seems to be a very nice guy. And I was just kind of uptight New York punk rock musician and... felt like I needed to wave the flag of I don't know what, and it was so stupid. I mean, I think that guy, I think he got a lot from his dad, who knew standards and knew a Richard Cord vocabulary, same as mine. But I think he's really a good creative artist, Paul McCartney.
Yeah, I mean, I think some would say that the saccharine side is not his best side, you know, and certainly Ebony and Ivory is.
Not the best.
Is not his best work, yeah.
It's a nice idea, but you've got to, you know, you're talking about dissonance in the DBs. The problem with that idea is when you actually go and play the black keys and the white keys together, a lot of people run.
That's interesting.
And so that was kind of the flaw.
Right, the metaphor of the whole song does not work at all, yeah.
it works except for your ears, yeah.
Wow. Yes, I think you say in the book that he would sort of pop his head in the studio and say, hello, DBs, and it sort of sounds like the cartoon Beatle Paul McCartney.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that's kind of funny.
And then that was all funny for us country boys in that we had a tape op all that week named Renata, and she was a sweetheart, but she didn't say much. She just brought us cookies and stuff like that. A couple of months later, she married Elton John, which is just weird on so many levels.
Yes. Huh.
That. It didn't last, that marriage.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like it. But the second record is a much more of a... Not much more, but it's a little more of an open record. You know, it's not...
Well, it was recorded in one studio at the same time, whereas the other first DB's record is more like a bunch of singles in that it would be recorded at a ton of different studios and not always under the best circumstances, like, you know, late at night or... when the time was cheap. But we went to the Who's studio in London and we just stayed there for it seemed like forever, but I think 3 weeks, and we made a record,
right, which is different than
whatever done, yeah,
trying to sneak into some studio off hours,
yeah,
and finish up something quickly. So when you have those tools of the Who's studio at your disposal, was it, what were you able to achieve results, you know, what was it a myth, that sort of idea of the tools will help you create this thing, or did it work out to be true for you?
The tools were great. Scott Litt was great. I mean, he knew how to use the tools. Power Station, he'd come from Power Station in New York, and Power Station was really redefining a lot of approaches to recording. There was some bombast there that has fallen away, but it was a kind of cut to the chase, really, you know, using old technology. The Neve boards and you know, Pultex and the stuff we liked too. So the tools were great. It was more the people.
It's amazing the amount of people who came out of Power Station, the amount of records and people who end up having careers as producers.
Oh, I loved that place. I would hang out there as much as they'd let me.
Okay, what did you see happening there when you hung out?
You know, I remember David Bowie asleep on the couch while Niles trying to make his Let's Dance record.
Wow.
And, you know, I remember Tony Bon Jovi recording with Aerosmith right before they thought of Run DMC, and Tony came out and said, Chris, it's like working in the Museum of Natural History. I have lots of little memories like that, but it was like being around a winning team. Let's do it. It's going to be a hit. They were coming off. I mean, Chic was there, and Chic had done really well with fantastic sounding records. Talking Heads had made a record there that sounded great. And it seemed like we were walking into tradition. I mean, Tony Bon Jovi had gotten a tape recorder when he was a kid like us, and he called up Berry Gordy and said, "Hey, Mr. Gordy, I know how you're making those records." And Berry laughed and flew him out to Motown, and he was like the mascot assistant at Motown. So that was coming from ancient knowledge. And this is something that is sad about laptop recording. There are all these amazing things being done, but the tradition of you get the tea in the studio and learn from the masters is going away.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned, just quickly, because we have so little time, your life in North Carolina growing up, your father's a doctor, and moving to New York, how does that culture shift? Is that something we can hear? Is that on the records? You know what I mean? It's kind of a...
I when I think back on living in New York, I think that the fight or flee impulse was somewhat engaged at all times. Not that it was that dangerous, although the Bowery was a little bit risky at the time I lived down there. But there is a kind of an edginess. Tempos are faster. It's a little colder. Tempos are always faster in colder climates because you want to keep warm. I do think it affects. Everything affects. Was that your question?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But mainly it was like, wow, this is the greatest thing ever. I was totally the guy in the Stevie Wonder song. I love it. I mean, there's a song about Manhattan on this record that they should hear, too, that's a little bit corny, but it's really true.
But you didn't decide I'm going to have a family and raise them in New York City. Why not?
When I married Dana, we talked about it, but it felt right to be in North Carolina. And, it's like an hour away. I mean, I'm close enough. Well, it's really 2 hours away, but it's an hour flight.
Right.
It's easy.
Two hours in security and 45 minutes in the airport. What are you going to do on New Year's Eve?
I should figure that out.
Yeah. Earlier I mentioned that all the different iterations of these first two DB's records that I have, the singles, the tin can, the cassettes, right, the LPs. Do you own all of those, any of those?
I probably have them. I've got a tin can, but the cassette's gone.
But it's clearly not important to you that your house is a museum of the DBs, right?
Yeah, that's pretty far-fetched.
I don't know. If you go into Rex's house, it's a museum of Rex. Well, some artists have a lot of their own...
I have a lot of sheet music from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. That's more what you'd see if you went in.
The
piano is right in front of you, and there's, mid-century, last century, obviously, sheet music.
When when the band was going, they were sort of red hot in New York City in that sort of, 79 to 81, 82 time, opening for a lot of bands, playing a lot of gigs, very busy. Were there folks who saw the band and loved the band who their liking the band meant something to you?
We loved NRBQ, who are, by the way, playing tomorrow night here at Monty Hall. And so when I started doing some things with Terry Adams and he seemed into the DBs, that meant a lot.
Yeah. He plays on some of your records and some of Aaron Peters' records.
Yeah. He was the only trouble with Terry is he had to figure out the right hat for everything.
He brings a lot of hats with him?
Yeah, and changes them to fit the song.
That's the secret.
Or he did. He's got a lot of the secrets, that guy. Very deep.
Oh, I interviewed one of the newer NRBQ guys, and I sort of equated it to like when you become president and they whisper the launch codes, or they tell you about the UFOs or something. Like, when he brings you into the van, does he tell you the secret? You know, okay, here's how we do it, you know. It's this, you know.
But, right.
But it's more ethereal than that. I don't think you can put your finger on it or put it on your head. Well, I think, you know, we just scratched the surface, but I think that was the plan. ChrisDamey.com is the place for information. Your newest record is called New Songs for the 20th Century. You are playing tonight at City Vineyard in a what sounds like it's going to be a great show. I assume it won't just be songs from the newest record. It'll be a little bit of a career retrospective, or no?
We're going to see. We have worked up some of the older songs, but when I just wrote this new group of songs last month, and so we're actually playing some things that no one's ever heard except for us.
Oh.
And I'm really excited about that. If I were coming, I would like that.
And you mentioned that the DBs almost played this Cat's Cradle Festival thing, so I guess the DBs playing more is possible.
An answer to that would probably commit me to something.
Well, possibility is, I'm committing you to the possibility of it happening. Well, I'm saying it is.
If we're at the Dakota and Lorne Michaels offers us, you know, $500, we're glad to come down.
You will go down
as long as we're not too
jump
tired.
In a taxi. That's great. I think that's going to happen. Thanks, Chris. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Totally great to be here.
Rex is next. I'll be back next week.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated? Good night.
Folks, you're listening here to the mighty WFMU Storms, WMFU Mount Hope, New York City, and Rockland County, 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org.